This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. When Cardi Raper came of age in the late 30s, early 40s, one of the main reasons for a young woman to go to college was to find a husband. But Raper was more interested in science. She did marry, married a scientist, in fact, who was well known for his work on mushroom reproduction. They forged a partnership based not only on love, but on a shared passion for biology. And then Cardi Raper went on to become a celebrated scientist in her own right. At the age of 88, this UVM professor emerita has written a book about what it was like to be a woman of science, and she's going to share her story with us today and with everyone to encourage more women into the profession. Cardi Raper joins me in the studio. It's such a pleasure to have you with us. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Jane. I admire your programs and have for a long time.
Oh, thank you very much.
Very pleased to be here.
Well, it was a pleasure to read your book, A Woman of Science, and I loved hearing about your childhood growing up in Plattsburgh. And you write that you wished when you were a little kid that you could be a boy because you wanted to do what all of your older brothers were able to do. What do you think it was? How were you held back as a child in the 20s and 30s?
Well, I realized when I was in third grade, I attended the practice school of what was then called the normal school. That is the Plattsburgh Teachers College. And we had an itinerant science teacher who came in and taught science as just a grand adventure. He had us do hands-on projects. He and my brother and I were so entranced by that I remember one evening coming home for the dinner time, announcing at the dinner table to my mother, "When we grow up, Johnny and I want to be scientists." Mom said, "Well, that's nice, dear. Jonathan can be a doctor and you can be a nurse." "But Mom, that isn't what I want to do. I want to discover things."
Well, it sounds like you had some fortitude inside of you from an early age that whatever anybody else told you a woman could do, you believed you could do more.
Well, my brothers were always teasing and testing, and I think it was tough love. So they strengthened me, and I would go to my mom, and I'd say, "Mom, they're teasing me again." She said, "Don't pay any attention. Either don't pay any attention at all. They're just trying to get your goat, or tease them back." So that's what I learned to do.
Your mother said, "You can be a nurse, dear." But your mother and your father were also very encouraging of your desire to continue your education. They were happy to have you go off to college.
Oh, yes.
A scholarship to Syracuse.
I should be an educated woman, find an educated man, and raise educating children.
Which we should say you did all three of those things. But you went to Syracuse and you started to study science, and you didn't find it the same as what you had found in that third grade science class. It wasn't that excitement in learning.
You're right. It was taught science then in most places was taught more as a litany of facts to memorize. And I almost lost interest. I almost switched fields. I became very interested in sociology and psychology and all those other subjects.
But you persevered. You actually transferred. You went to the University of Chicago to finish up your undergraduate career in science.
Yes.
What made you stick with it?
I met John Raper with flaming red hair. I called him Red. He taught me to love the fungi. And then, of course, we fell in love, which you weren't supposed to do in those days.
Also, it was your mom who told you to find an educated man to marry.
I did. And I also took several courses from a very famous geneticist, Sewell Wright, who was the first to interpret Mendel's inheritance problems, or thesis, through genes and the genome. So I got very excited about genetics.
And when you finished your undergraduate career, you went straight into a graduate career. You thought, "I'm going to get a master's. I'm going to continue studying this stuff."
I did, but that was because I didn't know what else to do, sort of. And when I met Red Raper, he seemed to want me in his lab. He was a new professor then. And so there I was, a graduate student and a technician. He was paying me, so that helped.
You also had a job outside of the university when you were studying. You needed to make some extra dough. And your first job, not on a campus setting, was in an FBI lab. Can you describe what you were doing?
It wasn't an FBI lab. I had to get FBI Q clearance to have this job. It was my first job, actually. at Argonne National Laboratories, which was managed by the University of Chicago. It was an old horse stable across the Midway in a very bad part of Chicago. And I would bicycle back and forth to work, taking my life in my hands.
And what were you doing there? I mean, this wasn't tops. You did have to get clearance, but we're not talking about, you know, building the H-bomb.
Oh, no. It was silly that I had to have clearance. I studied paramecium, and that's a cute little protist that looks like a Viking ship with lots of oars, if you look at it under the microscope. And we could do some genetics with that. And I was studying the effects of nitrogen mustard, which was used in World War I as a poison gas. I think it's still being used to some extent. I studied the genetics of the effects of the nitrogen mustard as compared to X-rays, X-irradiation, and found some really interesting stuff, but I won't go into that.
Oh, give us just a little bit of it. We've got to have some of the science here.
Well, nitrogen mustard affects the physiology of this little organism far more than making mutations, whereas X-rays, by contrast, are more likely to cause mutation. It gets more complicated.
So if you were studying that, the effect of mustard gas on the paramecium, was the idea that somehow this would lead to us better understanding the effects on humans?
Yes, yes. But, of course, what happened in World War II was that we were more interested in what happens with beta rays and gamma rays from the atom bombs, which is what my husband, John Raper, studied at Manhattan Project in Oak Ridge.
We're talking today with Cardi Raper, a woman of science. That's the title of her memoir, A Woman of Science, An Extraordinary Journey of Love, Discovery, and the Sex Life of Mushrooms. She's telling us a little bit about her journey through the science field, also as a wife and a mother. And we're going to talk a little bit about this field, the reproductive life of mushrooms, which has fascinating stories within it itself. If you have questions about any of that, if you want to talk about what it's like to be a woman of science, to be a woman in the hard sciences, and what it was like to be a woman in the sciences before there were many others, you can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Professor Raper, once you were in the lab when you were studying under John Raper, were you one of the only women there at that time as well?
I was his first graduate student, and his later graduate students were all male until he moved to Harvard, and then he had several females there.
And did it feel to you like you were pioneering, or was it just what you wanted to be doing and you sort of had your head down and didn't think about it?
I did not think of myself as a pioneer. I just was passionate about science and the whole process of this being a process of discovery. And it just, to me, it was so exciting.
So what were you and Red working on?
At the time, we were working on a little water mold, which has since been declassified as a fungus. I think it's a protist that communicates its sex life through steroid hormones. And it can be either male or female, depending on who it meets. If it meets another critter that's a little bit stronger male than itself, then it becomes female, and vice versa. And that was a fascinating system to look at, but we couldn't do the genetics. We couldn't get to the next generation. We couldn't do matings and look at the progeny and find out what the genetic base of that was.
The science just hadn't developed far enough yet?
It's a recalcitrant organism. You have to find the right organism to study.
So does nobody still know how that works in this process?
It's very hard to know what the genes are that are involved, even with the Genome Project to this point. But then we moved on to a wood-rotting mushroom that was very malleable in the lab. You could grow it, you could keep it, you could cross it, you could ship it all around the world in envelopes and make big collections that way. And the fascinating thing about that was that we knew from way back in the 1920s, a German by the name of Kniep had discovered that it has many different sexes, not just two. And we wondered, well, what could be the basis of that? How can that possibly be? And, of course, we made a genetic approach. So we identified that there are genetic loci and that within these loci are other genes.
So if there are multiple different sexes, does that mean whatever sex one of these fungi is, it can mate with any other fungi of any other sex? Is that how it works?
Yeah, pretty much. It's a big outbreeder. It's very promiscuous. There's a restriction of inbreeding, of the progeny between a single cross, within a single cross, or consequence of a single cross, can only mate compatibly amongst themselves to the extent of about 25%. But out in nature, these fungi, these sexual spores get around, jet stream, whatever, all over the world. And the new kid on the block can mate with anybody of its own species up to a point of about 98% or more.
So that does make it seem like quite promiscuous, but also would make it easier for these kinds of fungi to just spread everywhere.
They do. It's a very successful fungus, and it's very valuable because it helps rot the fallen logs in the forest and clean up the forest, recycle the contents and so forth, help the plants grow, help the trees grow. But it is found on all the continents that grow wood.
While you were studying this, were you in this lab, you and Red and the others who were working with you, the first to discover that there are multiple sexes in an organism? Or were other people discovering this in other organisms at the same time?
No, it had been discovered way back in the 1920s in our wood rotting fungus, which is called Schizophyllum, and another fungus, Coprinus, which people find in the woods or and they're edible. But nobody knew the genetic basis or the molecular basis by any means.
Why is that important?
It is important because it's a basic bit of science. One wants to know what does run a sexual recombination. It's an extremely important process in biology. It's how you recombine genomes and mix genomes and get new varieties that, try out different environments and either perch where it happens to be, and the best ones in that particular environment will be selected to go on into another life cycle.
For someone who's not very interested in or thinks they're not very interested in science or says, well, that's great, Cardi. Congratulations for figuring that out. I'm going to go back to my life over here. I mean, does it have applications? Do we know things because of this research into fungi that is important to our lives?
Yes, we do. In fact, when the molecular age dawned, and this was after my husband died and I had to learn those techniques of molecular genetics, it was possible then to clone genes, see what they're encoding and what kind of molecules they ultimately make. And what we found out, to our surprise, was that the molecules involved in the mating process of this organism are molecules that we as humans use to sense our environment as in terms of smell, taste, and sight, and probably sex. That has not been proven.
You're talking pheromones now?
I'm talking pheromones, yep.
Well, so there's an area of focus for you. You're only 88. You could move on to human pheromones.
Well, actually, my son is a neuroscientist, and he is finding in his studies of the development of the nervous system that there are receptors for pheromones that are very similar, of a similar type to what the fungi use to find their mates in the development of the nervous system and how the nerve finds its way to wire itself properly.
Now, see, we promised mushroom sex would be interesting, and here we are. We're getting right to the heart of it already. We're talking with Cardi Raper, UVM Professor Emerita in Microbiology and Molecular Genetics. We're discussing her life in science. We're learning a little bit about her field of focus, mushroom reproduction, and we're hearing about what it was like to come of age in a time when there weren't a lot of women in science. Listeners, if you have questions for Cardi Raper or if you want to share your own experiences in science, give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Cardi Raper is my guest today. She ended a long career in molecular genetics and microbiology at the University of Vermont. And in her retirement, she's written a memoir called A Woman of Science, An Extraordinary Journey of Love, Discovery, and the Sex Life of Mushrooms. And we're hearing about all of that today, including the fascinating reproductive behavior of the fungus among us. Listeners, if you have experience as a woman in the hard sciences that you'd like to share, or if you have a question about mushroom biology, give us a call, 1-800-639-2211, or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We've talked a little bit about Red, John Raper, who was your mentor and who you worked for when you were getting your master's. And as you said, you did fall in love with each other. He became your husband. It was a fraught time. He was married to someone else when you met, and it was this very difficult, emotional time to get together. But you did get together, and you went on to have a couple of children, and you stayed home for a little while. And you write in the memoir that you never quite felt comfortable as a homemaker. It didn't quite sit well with you. You felt better when you were working in the sciences, and in fact, it was better for your marriage as well.
That's true. I mean, I did like keeping a home, and I love those children, and I love being there when they ask those difficult questions like, why can't I marry my brother? And how come I can talk to my stepbrother all the way down in North Carolina when I'm here in Lexington and, you know, explaining, well, there are wires overhead and your voice is going through those wires. So it's, you know, it was worthwhile staying home with them, but it was kind of a communal effort. I lived in Lexington, Mass, and there were two other families that, mothers with similar attitudes. So we got together, we pooled our children, and then we tried to do other things to help the community.
And when you decided to go back to work in Red's lab, how was that treated among your social circle?
That was treated well. My husband always respected what I was able to do. And even though he was the principal and he gave the talks, whenever I went to seminars with him, he would defer to me because I was at the bench and I was doing the research and I got those results. And he knew that I could, you know, convey the meaning of it in a way that he couldn't. So I was very well respected within the laboratory. It's just that I wasn't recognized much outside the lab.
Well, and in fact, when you were doing your own research, you would find sometimes that your name would either be excluded completely or put at the very end of the contributors in an essay that was going into a scientific journal.
That was much earlier, not under my husband, Red. In fact, in the days when we were at Harvard, I was in his lab, my name would come first on a paper in those days, and that was important. Now, if I were the most important investigator, it would come at the end. It's very interesting. No, that what you're referring to is my experience at Argonne Labs, and I had a learning experience there that I had to insist on some recognition.
When you were a little bit older, when your children were in college, your husband died suddenly.
Yes.
And you had to figure out how to then, obviously how to go on in life without him and without having your partner and having your children's father with you, but also professionally. You had worked in his lab for so long, and now what? And how were you going to be out on your own doing this work? Do you think that marrying John Raper in the end was beneficial for your career because it advanced you in so many ways within his lab? Or was it a detriment in the sense that you weren't out on your own?
It was absolutely a benefit because he was very well known in the international field. And his students recognized my abilities. So they were very helpful to me. The colleagues were rather reluctant to take me into their labs. So I decided through a brown bag lunch that women held at Harvard in those days, that really what I had to do is get the union card, which was the doctorate. So I did.
And then you ran your own lab for 30 years.
I did. I started out at Wellesley College. Didn't get tenure there. Came to the University of Vermont, which was one of the best moves I've ever made. and did the major research here.
We have a caller on the line, Larry, who's calling in from Windsor, who has a question for you. Hi, Larry. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm kind of curious. You know, I've always had a good garden, but I wanted to start, you know, with mushrooms in my basement. And the big question is, how do you get the spores? Do you leave a few so they reproduce, or do they just spore out themselves?
Well, they make spores, and they drop their spores, but I don't know how did you start making mushrooms in your basement?
I haven't, but I've always had an interest in it, and I listen to NPR all the time, and this is one conversation I wouldn't miss.
Well, there's a company called Fungi Perfecti that you can look it up online that sells kits for making the kinds of edible mushrooms. Are you interested in eating mushrooms?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, you can go online and find that company, and they will ship you these little kits with compost and the spawn, they call it, making all kinds of edible mushrooms, and that can be a lot of fun.
Larry, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate that. We got a note from Barbara as well, who writes, I have a daughter who's 11 years old, and she thinks she would like to study STEM, science, technology, engineering, math. She doesn't quite understand what this means, but I'm wondering if Professor Raper has suggestions for encouraging young girls in science.
Mm-hmm. You have to really love it, and it'll be hard. It's a very difficult field. Because if you go into science, you got to find some kind of a job. You have to get some kind of support. It's very competitive. So what carries you is your utter passion for the field. Find an area of science that really intrigues you. Get into it. Get your hands into it. Get your hands on. Get involved. And if you find you really love it, you'll make it.
Well, and in fact, that's part of why you wrote this book, right? To encourage more women in the sciences.
Yes, but it's not easy.
Do you find now, I mean, when we look at the statistics, and you write a little bit about this as well, there are women who are entering these fields in high school and in college and undergraduate studies in equal measures to boys. But then as you go up the ranks, it diminishes. There are still fewer women in the higher ranks. Do you see that changing, though?
Well, certainly there's at least equal number of women, maybe more, entering at the undergraduate level. And then at the graduate level, it's maybe about 50-50. But you get to the postgraduate level and postdoc level, and finally in academia anyway, a tenure track job and a tenure, it wanes. It decreases. The proportion decreases. And I think there are many reasons for that. I don't think it's just that it's all so male-dominated. I think it's the way women are. Women just are different from men, by and large. I think we tend to be more nurturing. We are the ones that bear the children, and there's that bond. And the field has become more and more competitive, so that works against trying to juggle that with your homemaking.
Do you think you could do now what you did when your children were little and return to the field?
I think that would be more difficult. And I think I did definitely have the advantage of having worked and written papers with my husband before he died. But I don't know how if you drop out now, that means you write fewer papers and you have fewer grants and your credentials are less than the competitors who stayed in the field consistently.
Which you found, I mean, you had trouble with that when you returned as well. You were worried about who's going to hire me? What am I going to do? I don't
Absolutely.
Have the publications that other people do at my age.
And I also felt that maybe there was some age discrimination.
Yes, you got your PhD at 52.
52, looking for a low-key job or low-point job.
Well, and then, you know, I was reading in your memoir, and you retired from UVM in 1994, but of course then you stayed on and continued running your lab until 2004. So you didn't even retire until you were 80, really. Are you slowing down yet, or are you, I mean, you've just written this book. Are you still doing more?
Oh, my new career is writing, and that's taken quite a lot of effort. I had learning a whole new way to write. I've written many scientific papers, but you don't write like a science paper, what I've tried to write. Right now, I'm working on a new book about my husband's family. There are 8 children, all brought up in a poor tobacco farm in North Carolina, and they talk of their life together as children and how growing tobacco is just the most difficult crop, and it's so hard work. And they are very much exposed to religious experiences and so forth. But the father said, you children aren't going to grow up to be farmers. You're going to help me now, but you're all going to university. And they did, every one of them. And they all became very distinguished urban professionals. So I think I have a lot of good material in that book.
It sounds like it. And I don't want to let you go without letting you tell us a joke, because the title of our show today is A Fungus Walks Into a Bar, and you say you actually have a mushroom joke or a fungus
joke.
Well,
I thought up one when I saw how you introduced my appearance here. So I made up a shaggy mushroom joke. Mushroom walks into the bar. Bartender says, hey, fungi, what'll you have? Well, I just fell off a compost wagon. I think I'll just have a tall glass of water and the usual side dish of bugs.
So is this what you were doing in your brown bag lunches? You guys were all just coming up with good fungi jokes?
No, the brown bag lunch. This one I just made up last night. No, the brown bag lunches, which included the technicians and secretaries and everybody at Harvard in biolabs. We all talked about, you know, what's the problem of being a woman in this very definitely male-dominated environment? And usually they would talk about how they would, you know, get pinched in the elevator. That never happened to me because my husband was chair, and I think they were a little more cautious.
Well, you'll find those stories and more in Cardi Raper's new book, A Woman of Science, An Extraordinary Journey of Love, Discovery, and the Sex Life of Mushrooms. Cardi Raper is UVM Research Associate Professor Emerita in Microbiology and Molecular Genetics. And we have links to her upcoming readings in Vermont. You'll find them at vpr.net. Dr. Raper, thank you very, very much for being on the program.
Oh, I so much enjoyed it. Thank you.
Coming up, artist Kate Gridley talks about her new portrait exhibit of young adults frozen in a time of great transition. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. When I stepped into the large gallery at the Southern Vermont Arts Center in Manchester last week, painter Kate Gridley was looking at a little device that measures humidity. She was putting the finishing touches on her new exhibit, Passing Through, Portraits of Emerging Adults. The room was too humid and the oil canvases were wrinkling. But the climate control was kicking in, and slowly but surely the paintings were straightening out. Each of the 17 paintings are accompanied by sound portraits that visitors can access through their cell phones. And Gridley described the exhibit further as she showed me around.
The room we are in, I would say the space is at least 30 feet by 30 feet. The walls are a pale green. And about every 36 inches, there is a canvas. And the canvases are 5 feet tall, 30 inches wide. And on each canvas, there is a over life size, very realistic painting in oil of a young person who is somewhere between the ages of 18 and 25. Each subject in here, when they came in to pose for me, I asked them to choose what they would wear, and their clothes will tell you a lot about them. They asked me if they should dress up, and I said, absolutely not. I wanted them to wear clothes that they were really comfortable in. So I said, you can come in your pajamas. It doesn't matter to me. But clothes do reveal something about the person that they drape. And on some level, the choice of jewelry or necktie or hair ornament or scarf or symbolic t-shirt, those become attributes of the person who is wearing them.
Well, in that case, why don't you tell me about this young man who is wearing a sports coat and khaki pants, and his hair is dyed. He looks like he might be sort of half blonde, half dark hair, but then he's got these nice pink streaks in his hair.
Well, he is a very interesting young man. His name is Tim, and he is, in my mind, a musical prodigy. At the time, he was modeling for me. He was very interested in conducting. He is a young man who plays the piano, the bassoon, the flute, the electric guitar. He is also a composer. He has been commissioned to write music for the Vermont Symphony Orchestra, the Vermont Youth Orchestra. And during his photo shoot, I said, let's talk about what it is that you, with your composer lens, you know, listen to as you observe the world. I observe the world visually. He observes the world through his ears.
Composers are just being influenced by everything because it's just what they're listening to, and you can't help but hear just everything. You know, we have music playing all the time. Wherever we are, there's music playing, and we're just kind of saturated with the sound, and so that all influences what you do because it's all the input. It's going to come out somehow. Jackhammer, I mean, it could be an awuga, siren, laughing sound, water running. It can be a saw wave. It can be a square wave. It could be a wobble, whatever you want, you know? And yeah, we just kind of try and extract these different elements from the world, and I guess that's what art is.
And so he was talking about music, and he was talking about conducting and conveying a sense of music. And what I hope is happening in this portrait is that you can feel him moving as if he were conducting. His hands are about to move, but he's not actually looking at the viewer. He's one of two paintings out of 17 where he's not engaging the viewer directly. But I hope that you have a sense that he's listening and that he's thinking about what he's hearing. Now, why the jacket? At that time when he was performing, he used to dress a little more formally, and he used to wear a more formal shirt. That's not the case anymore. He now wears t-shirts with big, bright patterns on them, and he has a shaved head, and he has a beard. The pink hair was a time that he went through when he was dyeing his hair different colors. He was trying on different persona, I think. And when he came in for a visit one day, he had this bright, bright pink hair. And I said, Tim, that's the hair I want. Because I feel like he has a pretty powerful brain. And for me, it was like a fire in his head.
Well, and that's also part of the point of this exhibit, isn't it? That these are all people in transition trying to figure out who they are at that age where everybody's trying to figure out, who am I, what do I want to be, and what do I want to look like?
It's true. And what's really interesting is if you think about the dichotomy between the fact that most people in this group are posting photographs of themselves, selfies, you know, on Facebook or Instagram or other social networking media. And yet these are oil portraits. These are salon-size oil portraits of a generation that most of the time are not depicted in salon-style oil portraits. It's just not done. It was done a long time ago.
When there was no pink hair.
When there was no pink hair, but they wore really elaborate costumes, think about it. And generally, those paintings would have been only commissioned by families of upper socioeconomic bracket.
And that's not the case with these subjects?
Oh, no. In this 17, which granted, it's not meant to be an overall slice of the world, not by any means. These are 17 young people who happen to come through my life. But there is every socioeconomic bracket inside this group. There is a ninth generation Vermonter. There is also the young man who was, when my children were growing up, our Fresh Air Fund child from New York City. It also happens that my two sons are in this group. And originally, I was not going to include them, but in fact, they are the gateway to most of the young people who are in the show. They were their friends, or there's another young man whom we hosted who came to us for his junior year in high school from Germany through AFS. At another point, we hosted a Middlebury College student from Botswana, and when he arrived in this country for 4 years of higher education, he wasn't going home. And so he had a home to come to for Christmas or Thanksgiving if he didn't get a better invitation.
You want to tell us about another one? You want to pick it?
Well, let's talk about the ninth generation Vermonter, whose name is Caleb. And he is depicted here. He's got his hands up as if he's pushing the sort of through a door, which happens to be the opening of the canvas. And he has a T-shirt on that says, "Music is my life." And he's got a wonderful, huge, fluorescent pink earring in his ear and a telephone cord necklace around his neck. And then he has a wonderful baseball cap on. And the thing about Caleb is he is interested in poetry. He represented Vermont in the national poetry competition. He's interested in slam poetry and rap music. And so in his sound portrait, he talks about where he gets his ideas and how he writes his poems. And it's pretty interesting. He's very down to earth. At the time he modeled for me, he wasn't sure he wanted to go to college. And about 6 months later, he decided he would go, and he went out to Otterbein in Ohio, where he's majored in things to do with film and radio and sound and theater. At the end of his sound portrait, he talks about how he wishes there were a museum devoted to language, which he would call the word Smithsonian. And then he laughs.
What if there was a museum or an exhibit that was specifically designated to words, which I've coined the word Smithsonian? In this location, there could either be paintings of famous individual writers, there could be their books, or there could just be single words on display. Just one word in a glass case that you can go and look at. Pneumonia, hors d'oeuvres, subtle. Because all these words can be pronounced differently depending on who you are. And what does this word mean to me? How does this word affect me? Paintings 10 feet tall of Robert Frost, web spun from the words of W.E.B., words from a lady named Emily, booklets and envelopes of famous man's words that taught you of the walrus, the carpenter, the bird. I just sit and take it all in, listen to the walls of the words from Smithsonian words.
Why did you want to include sound portraits along with the visual portrait of all of these people?
Initially, it started out, it was going to be a series of paintings, because I was interested in the body language and what the clothes signified and what could you figure out about these young people just from what was represented in the window. But then as they sat and as we did the photo sketches and as we talked, I realized that they have really amazing stories and really interesting things to say. And so I thought, well, with this generation, we could have those stories as wall text, but that felt old-fashioned and dusty and inappropriate. And so we came up with the idea of creating a sound portrait that would be accessible by cell phone, because cell phone is one of the ways that they interface with each other and with the world. And that's not a new idea per se, but it was brand new for me. And it just adds a layer, a digital layer, in a way, to paintings that initially, when you see them, feel somewhat old world.
Let's talk about one more, one of the girls.
Okay. Oh, you choose.
Oh, that's so hard to choose. I want to choose the one next to your son.
All right. This is EJ, and EJ has very short hair. She has what she tells me is a faux hawk, which was new for me. And she has on a nice wrinkled men's white polo button-down shirt. And she has on, let's go a little closer, she has on her uncle's thin necktie. And she has a wonderful bracelet around her left hand. And you can see the hint of a tattoo on her arm. She's a really cool, strong young woman whose passions are her horses. And she's also now an advocate. When she was in college, she came out and she was at a small college that was located in a community where she experienced some pretty awful homophobic experiences in the downtown. And so she talks about that in her sound portrait.
coming out and then meeting the queer community is kind of like being reborn, if you will. Like, everybody who comes out of the closet has to relearn how to date, has to relearn how to navigate social situations, because it's very, very different. I identify as a soft butch genderqueer gay person who sleeps with women, dates women. So it's all very complicated.
At the moment, she dreams of becoming a professor of queer studies. And she also dreams of having a horse rehabilitation farm that would be useful for rehabilitating abused horses, but also be a place that young people could come to for therapeutic purposes.
Because he's right next to EJ, we have to talk about your son, because you can see so clearly in this portrait that he has his cell phone in his pocket.
He does. He has his cell phone in his pocket, and you will notice from the pose of his right hand that there is a possibility he might have been holding a cigarette.
And perhaps a pack of cigarettes in the other pocket.
And perhaps, although now we're saying it's a pack of cards, because he did have a cigarette in this painting, and he got so much grief about it. He came to me and said, I want you to take that cigarette out. And maybe I'm revealing too much here, but it's a good story. I said, well, there's only one way that cigarette's going to come out of the painting, and that's if you quit. And he said, well, that'll never happen. But then he did. So I removed the cigarette.
That's probably the perk of being the mom and the painter.
I know. So unfortunately, he had a little connection.
Okay, thank you very much, and best of luck with the exhibit.
Thank you very much.
Kate Gridley's exhibit, Passing Through, Portraits of Emerging Adults, is on display at the Southern Vermont Art Center in Manchester through October 21st. We have a link to her website at vpr.net. Dilapidated barns and silos are almost as iconic around here as the Holstein cows grazing nearby. But it's lamentable that so many old, beautiful silos are in such disrepair. Agriculture has changed a lot over the years, and the physical infrastructure that's required has changed along with it. For a little history, we asked Roger Rainville, a farmer in Alberg, for his explanation of why so many silos are tottering in the fields.
One of the reasons is that farmers have expanded to the point where silos aren't big enough, they're not efficient enough to use, because it takes time to run the feed out and run it into a mixer. A lot of farmers have custom harvesters now that come in with real big equipment. They wouldn't come to my farm to harvest because it takes too long to unload and blow the feed into these silos. So they wouldn't come here. Most farmers are using bunkers. They're putting feed in the bunker. It's real fast. They use a front-end loader to empty the bunker out, to load into a mixer, feed the cows, and it's just five times faster than the silos. A lot of farmers have gone to round bales. The marshmallows in the field and stuff is just because of labor that one man or one woman can go out there and rake the hay, then come back and grab the round bale them and go out and get them later. You know, I remember as a kid, my father had the wooden silos, and I was little, and it was all by hand, you know. Everything was harvested by hand. The corn wasn't. Then it was chopped up at the silo with a chopper blower, they called it. And they'd put a milk can, 10-gallon milk can, in the bottom of the silo with a piece of cheesecloth over it. And then, of course, he always put the corn in greener because the silos weren't very big. And if they put it in the corn too dry, it wouldn't ferment properly, it wouldn't pack properly, so it'd be oxygen getting to it and it would spoil. So they just started harvesting earlier, and there was a lot of juices. So they'd strain those juices into that 10-gallon milk can, and then when the silo was empty, they'd take that 10-gallon, that can, and they'd stick it outdoors and let it freeze. And what didn't freeze, they drank. And that was really potent, potent stuff. You ask the real old folks, and they'll remember the old corn squeezings. It was especially during Prohibition. Nobody made moonshine around here that I knew of, but they did a lot of corn squeezing. I guess it's what you want to use. I mean, I like going in the barn in the winter when it's 20, 30, 40 below zero, not having to start the tractor to go haul feed out of the bunker, you know, and move 3 feet of snow. I like just pushing a button. These aren't ancient yet. They're not history yet.
Roger Rainville is a farmer at Border View Farms in Alberg, Vermont. He and his wife switched to research farming after 25 years in the dairy industry. And that will wrap up today's show. Tomorrow, Bob Kinzel will be joined by Representative Peter Welch for the full hour. Bob's here now. Bob, tell us what topics you're likely to hit on with the congressman.
Jane, Congressman Welch is a co-sponsor of a bill in the House to make it more difficult for the National Security Agency to monitor the emails and phone calls of millions of Americans as part of its effort to thwart future terrorist attacks. We'll talk about how the current worldwide terror alert is affecting the debate over this legislation.
And if you have a question for Congressman Welch, you can send it now to vermontedition@vpr.net and listen tomorrow at noon. Our show is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing. We have production assistance from Tim Johnson and Annie Pruitt. Mary Williams directed the program, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.